From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido is attempting a coup. He took to the streets of Caracas this morning with a small band of heavily armed troops. It's the most serious challenge yet to the administration of socialist Nicolas Maduro. We'll find out how many Venezuelans are hitting the streets to back Guaido's call to action. That all coming up in just 3 minutes. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. My thanks to Kyle Stokes for hosting in my absence yesterday. Coming up, we'll talk with women listeners of Air Talk who work at traditionally male-dominated jobs. Increasing numbers of American women are driving trucks, operating forklifts, working in factories and warehouses, and on construction sites. We'll hear details about those experiences. But first, as you just heard, more political turmoil in Venezuela. Opposition leader Juan Guaido called for people to take to the streets in an effort to topple the leadership of socialist Nicolas Maduro. Guaido seems to have the backing of some members of the military, but the depth of the coup attempt isn't clear at this point. Joining us is Andy's bureau chief at the New York Times, Nick Casey, where he covers for the Times most of South American countries, including Venezuela. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do we know about the depth of the coup attempt? Does it appear that the opposition leader has much support deep into the military?
Well, we know if it was a coup attempt, and that's not even clear at this point, that it wasn't a successful one. Usually coups start early in the morning. The first people that you see on television are the top brass of the military saying that they've taken control of the country. What happened in this case was Guaido went to a military base and said that he had the support of military leaders. But we haven't seen that yet. We see that he got onto the base. That he made a big declaration along with a political prisoner named Leopoldo López, calling people to join him. But whether or not that's actually happened, we haven't seen. And it doesn't look like, at least at this hour, that the top people who run Venezuela and the military have joined with him.
We've seen some groups of people in Caracas who've come out onto the streets. There have been clashes with armored vehicles in the streets. It doesn't appear from the limited video that I've seen that you've got masses of Caracas residents. Is there any way to get a sense of how much support he's getting with people taking to the streets?
Well, it's also hard for the people who want to get to the streets now because they've become pretty heavily militarized right now. And there's a lot of people fearing repression if they go out from the government. We don't know yet whether there's enough people to come out to really cause the ground to shake out there. There have been a number of times this year when big protests have been held in Venezuela, including in January when almost 2 million people came out. So one thing we can see is that Maduro, who is an authoritarian now, has been able to hold on even through big protests. And the large thing that people are waiting on today is to see whether the military turns on Maduro, because even more than the people in the streets, it's the people with the weapons that actually have control of who is in charge of Venezuela at this stage.
So we got a tweet from Maduro, nerves of steel, earlier today. But to your knowledge, has Maduro gone on television today? Has he made more of an appearance than just the tweet?
Well, Maduro and all of his top brass have been coming out mainly on Twitter to support him at this stage. It hasn't looked like Maduro's needed to come out in a bigger way than that at the time being. But if things get shaky for him throughout the course of the day, we'll just have to see what he does.
What's your sense of within the leadership of the military of the loyalty to Maduro's administration?
Well, it's mixed. I've met a lot of military men and women who have defected. They've come over to Colombia. They've gone on to other countries, and they want to get back into the country to free it, in their own words. There have been a number of mid-ranking people who have left publicly, and even some high-ranking people. But the people, the actual top military brass that work most closely with Maduro, have stayed on his side. And those are the figures that any coup or any attempt to wrest power from Maduro using the military is going to need. And so far, those people remain loyal to him because they receive a lot of benefits from his government. They have control of a lot of parts of the economy, including the oil industry. Many other key industries like the food and medicine industries are under control or indirectly under control of military leaders. So for the top people in this very corrupt government, it doesn't necessarily make sense yet to break with the president.
We're talking with Andy's bureau chief at the New York Times, Nick Casey. He covers most countries in South America, including Venezuela. He's talking with us about the attempted coup or whatever you call it, the call by the opposition leader Juan Guaido to bring people out to the streets, including calling on members of the military to turn on the Nicolas Maduro administration. And the question is, how deep is that support that Guaido has? Are people coming out in the streets in significant numbers? To what degree is Maduro's leadership threatened? Nick, what is the potentially most vulnerable part of the Maduro administration?
I think he has two big vulnerabilities, and you're seeing them both at play today. One is the 30 million people who are in Venezuela right now. These are people that don't have food. They don't have medicine that they need because of this economic crisis. And most recently, this year, they don't have electricity and water because this government has been so badly mismanaged for many years that it can't even provide basic services. So one of his main vulnerabilities is the fact that people don't have what the government provides. The second is the military. Although it hasn't turned on Maduro yet, it very well may. And the reasons for that is because Venezuela's military does fundamentally see itself as protectors of the population of Venezuela, not any particular president. They also are suffering from the same shortages of food and medicine. And many of the soldiers who are out there to repress protesters also have to face the fact that they come back in the evening and don't have anything in their refrigerator. So how long they will put up with the situation that Maduro has created, that's not clear. But so far they have.
And what's happened to all the oil revenue? Venezuela, a petroleum powerhouse. So where are those funds going?
Well, they're not going to the U.S. anymore, or from the U.S. To Venezuela. Those have been sanctioned by the U.S. government, which used to be the big buyer of Venezuelan petroleum in cash. The other places that the Venezuelan oil goes to are Russia and China, who are hold debts of Venezuela. So every day it's sending off many barrels of oil to those two countries to pay off billions of dollars in debt. And then the other recipient of Venezuela petroleum historically has been Cuba, which Venezuela supports with free petroleum in exchange for doctors, which actually have come down to Venezuela over the years to provide medical services.
Nick Casey, thank you so much for the very latest on what's going on in the streets of Caracas right now. We appreciate the update.
Thanks for the time.
All right. Nick Casey with us from the New York Times, also joining us from Pomona College right here in Southern California, professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College, Miguel Tincor Salas. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Your sense of just based on the reports you're hearing out of Venezuela, how much support does it seem that Guaido has?
Well, if the Guaido has to appeal to the military to join him, I think that's a sign that he doesn't have the military support. As Nick was saying earlier, when you have a coup, usually the first thing you see is the general staff announcing that they've taken power. Here we had just the opposite. The general staff did a press conference, including Vladimir Padrino, the head of the military, General Jesus Chorrio, Suarez Chorrio, the head of the army, all saying that they are loyal behind Maduro. So that tends to indicate that they don't have deep support. support. What I'm hearing from Venezuelan sources is that there were two military individuals who were involved primarily in the coup: Manuel Christopher Figueres, which is the head of military intelligence, and Lieutenant Colonel Ilich Sanchez, which was in charge of the protecting the Congress building. And those two are the ones that have been spearheading the uprising. The opposition doesn't want to call it an uprising; they want to call it a support for the Constitution. But by all appearances, it has been an effort at a coup, which for the time being is not being successful.
I was looking at the Associated Press reporting out of Caracas from Scott Smith and Christopher Torchia, and they were introducing some young people who said they were soldiers who were defected. And I'm wondering, since he doesn't appear to have the support of the leadership of the branches of the military, is Guaido, are there enough of the younger, rank and file soldiers who might see a benefit to joining his cause?
What you have to look for is a general who commands troops. If a general or a series of generals who commands troops or commands a military base joins the opposition, then you would have a change in scenario. What we don't have that right now. What we have is consolidation among the high elites in the military who control the bases and who still control the military base in Caracas, where Guaido appeared this morning. What this may be is an effort, which we saw Marco Rubio say a couple days ago, that on May 1st there would be a major turning point in Venezuela. This could be an effort at that, and also it's an effort at exacerbating the crisis, at provoking a crisis, at trying to test the waters to see if any further military had joined them. But so far, there has not been the massive support that Guaido has promised. And again, this has been going on since January 23rd, when Guaido announced his presidency. And here is that's the dilemma of Venezuela. There may be opposition to Maduro, but there is not trust in Guaido or the opposition. And that's the real challenge here in terms of how that opposition moves forward. And as long as it maintains a strategy of all or nothing, that is Maduro gone or nothing,
yeah,
they begin to lose support even within the opposition, because they keep claiming these dates: first January 23rd, then February 23rd, then April 23rd, and now May 1st, and they're not successful.
Well, and I'm wondering, with the risk that he's taking today, does Guaido put himself into irrelevance if this, as appears, just doesn't take off?
Well, not only into irrelevance, but into jail. And that may be what he wants, because having released Leopoldo López from house arrest, having joined him, having supported a coup, he really tips Maduro's hand. If Maduro does not arrest him now in the context of what has been a coup, then largely Maduro then loses support among his own base. So really, this was an effort at maybe provoking that crisis, forcing Maduro's hand to arrest him, and in so doing, trying to provoke in an international support or trying to provoke an international intervention.
We're talking with Pomona College professor Miguel Tinker Salas. He's professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona, author of Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know, which came out just about 3 years ago. He's written several books on the country, and we're talking about the developments in Caracas today. I also wonder about the exodus. What, some 3 million people have left the country, Professor? Is that largely a brain drain? Are these elites that are leaving? What effect do you see that having on the country?
No, it represents all social classes. And in fact, a large number of people who have been leaving have been the poor, because it's the poor who actually have been the most buffeted by this economic crisis. It's not that there's a famine in Venezuela. What there is scarcity. There is, again, inflation that is hyperinflation, the highest inflation in the world, which makes it difficult to purchase those goods and then makes you dependent on the government subsidies in order to be able to purchase food. So that's the dilemma. And then with the sanctions that have been imposed, it actually worsens the conditions within the country. And that's the tragedy, because, again, the sanctions are not going to affect Maduro. They're not going to affect the high generals. They're going to affect the mass of the population, who now will have seen the scarcities increased. And we saw a report just came out a couple days ago by Jeffrey Sachs and Mark Weisbrot that talked about the human consequences of those sanctions, potentially leading to thousands of deaths. So, again, sanctions, for me at least, are not an answer. They have not been an answer when applied in Cuba. They have not been an answer answer when applied elsewhere. And again, what they do is exacerbate already worse, bad conditions for the large number of the population.
So what finally gets Maduro to release power? Anything?
I think that there has to be a concerted effort at engaging in the political process, in changing the electoral system. And again, it has to be a step-by-step process. I don't think that the all-or-nothing strategy that has been applied up until now by the opposition will remove Maduro. And again, the military is a central component part of that. As long as they, along with even though Maduro is not the popular person he used to be, he still has between 20 and 25% support. And they are today marching at Miraflores Palace, protecting the presidential palace. You have to convince those individuals to join your cause as well. And they have not been able to build those bridges yet.
But those political reforms you're talking about with Maduro ever allow those to move forward?
Well, I think there has to be negotiations, and that's where the level of negotiations can. And again, this is the project that was proposed earlier by Mexico and Uruguay, by the European Union. What is the process of negotiation that gets us to fair and free elections to legitimate the political process in the country? Because I don't think that a military option, one that, again, builds on the military and puts the military in the center of Venezuelan politics, will long-term bring democracy to the country.
Professor, thank you again. We appreciate your joining us once more on Air Talk.
Thank you.
Miguel Tinker Salas, Pomona College Professor of Latin American History and Chicano Latino Studies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. An asteroid with a 1% chance of hitting Earth. That is the scenario, not the reality, but a scenario which is putting planning into motion to try and figure out what are the things we need to do to prepare if such a scenario is real. You're listening to Air Talk. Remember that film from a couple decades ago, Armageddon, about Earth trying to save itself from an asteroid the size of Texas on a collision course with Earth? Well, Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientists are looking at planning for what if we faced a scenario somewhat similar. What if we had an asteroid large enough to wipe out a city somewhere on Earth with a 1% chance that it would strike in less than a decade? How would we plan for that? What would be the biggest challenges? With us to talk about this simulation and how it's played out in earlier versions is Marina Brovovich, radar scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory here in the San Gabriel Valley. She's worked on radar observations of near-Earth objects and co-chaired a session on near-Earth objects this morning at the 2019 Planetary Defense Conference in Maryland. Thank you very much, Dr. Brovovich. Thank you for joining us on Air Talk.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So how many times has this mock asteroid project been carried out?
So Planetary Defense Conference has been going for a number of years, since early 2000s, and it's happening about every 2 years.
And each of them include this project to plan for a potential asteroid strike?
Well, we have many sessions where we actually discuss current science of asteroids. So we really are discussing our bread and butter. But we also have a part of the Planetary Defense Conference is an exercise. And there is a hypothetical scenario of there is something on its course to Earth and how would we react?
So in this case, spell out the parameters of this simulation. How big is the asteroid, and what's the time frame for a potential strike?
So, well, initially, you know what? We reveal the scenario day by day. So at this point, we just started our exercise, so I cannot reveal too much because I would be uncovering what we're doing this week. So we know very little at this point. We just know it's been discovered, and we know that for the following year, we will not be able to observe it with, either with telescopes. It's hiding behind the sun. So we have to come up with a plan. So that is always how the exercise starts. object shows up, very preliminary calculations, so just a few data points, indicate that there is a small percentage, small chance that it's going to impact Earth. What are you going to do?
And would this require, if this were real, sending some sort of a probe to the asteroid, or is it too far away that there wouldn't be time to actually get a probe there to bring back valuable information about the asteroid's composition?
So the odds are we would have many years, likely decades, to prepare in the case of such events. And that's what we work during these kind of exercises. We would definitely first go for a characterization mission, and then based on what that spacecraft tells us about what we are dealing with, then we would plan further.
We're talking with Marina Brozovich, who's a radar scientist at JPL here in Southern California. Also with us is Davide Farnocchia, who's an astronomer at JPL's Near Earth Object Studies. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
How would the scientific community work together on a project if this were real? You identified an asteroid with this 1% chance of striking Earth and doing catastrophic damage. How would the scientific community be able to mobilize itself?
That's actually, I think it comes out naturally because we all like what we're doing and we all want to have the best outcome. And so we have astronomers that try to get the best possible data of these objects, and this information is passed on orbit people that try to determine the trajectory and try to determine the impact location. And then we talk to the people designing the mission, and we try to understand what they need in order to be successful. And so we design the mission in such a way we can get the physical properties we need to design the right and most effective deflection attempt. So everybody is willing to contribute and provide their expertise.
I was under the impression that astronomers had identified the asteroids that that are out there that could potentially cause a risk, and that essentially this is not something we have to be concerned with. But are there smaller asteroids that could still do significant damage that we don't necessarily know are there?
Yeah, so what we've done so far is to discover more than 95% of the objects larger than 1 kilometer that could come our way. And now we're working our way towards smaller sizes, and that's going to take some time to reach the same level of completeness. But we have to keep in mind that events, impact events, are extremely unlikely. They happen on long time scales. Like an object of 200 meters only reaches the Earth on average every 100,000 years. So it's not something that happens every day.
But if it does, it could be catastrophic. Yeah, so if you had an asteroid of that size, impact on land, how much damage could it potentially do?
Well, so it really depends on the exact circumstances. But in this case, we would talk about continent scale. Devastation is not going to be a, end of civilization kind of event. And we have to keep in mind that we can do something about it. We can discover these objects in advance, and we can do our best efforts in order to prevent any damage.
Would we be able potentially to send an object up that would have enough thrust to be able, enough power to be able to change the trajectory of an asteroid of that size?
It depends on exact circumstances, again, but we do have the technology to make this happen.
So that could you could have a mission that would be able to do that and avoid an impact. How much time would it take to develop a mission that could carry that out?
I would say it takes about a few years, and it depends on how much work is done in advance, how soon you can actually launch. And that's why we're doing these impact scenarios, to see how long it would take and how much preparation needs to be done in advance.
Marina Brozovich, what were some of the impediments in the earlier simulations that you found in trying to address this? Maybe things you hadn't anticipated would be challenges. Oh, I guess we lost her. We lost Marina Brozovic of Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Davide, same question for you then. What came up in these earlier simulations?
Well, I guess there is one thing that scientists sometimes can underestimate is the political involvement, because what we have to do is to get the message across with a very different community, and there is different needs on their side, and so we need to be able to explain exactly what is going on. And in particular, when we have a 1% impact probability, the layman might think that that is a small number, and in fact it is, because there is a 99% probability that the impact is not going to happen. But if you compare that to the usual risk that you get from asteroids, 1% is pretty large. And so getting that message across might not be easy.
Well, and if that risk stayed at 1%, would there be a challenge in getting the funding necessary for an extremely expensive project like this to try and affect the path of the asteroid?
Well, I guess at 1%, you would get consideration. It is unclear whether you would get all the funding and green lights to actually fly the mission. So there is some kind of reason. The risk needs to be large enough to justify the cost involved with launching a mission.
All right. I want to thank you, Davide, for being with us. Davide Farnocchia, astronomer at JPL Center for Near-Earth Object Studies. The two joining us to talk about the 2019 Planetary Defense Conference, a simulation looking at an imaginary asteroid that is about 1,000 feet across, spotted 35 million miles from Earth, with a 1% chance of striking the surface of Earth. How do scientists deal with that risk? That's the exercise they're carrying out in Maryland. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Women are increasingly taking jobs in traditionally male-dominated blue-collar field. More women are working in construction as truck drivers, police officers, security guards, and much more. According to the Labor Department, 43% more women worked in transportation and material moving last year than just two decades ago. Women employed in construction increased nearly 25%, and the amount of women working in protective service jobs increased to more than 40% in the past two decades. So what's driving more women entering those blue-collar fields? I'd like to hear from you. If you are a woman who works in a field that has been traditionally male, traditionally blue-collar job, maybe it's working in a distribution warehouse, maybe you drive professionally, everything from long-haul trucking to local routes, house-to-house delivery, working in a field that's traditionally been male-dominated, what's your experience been working in a field like that? Maybe you work in construction. You go out to construction sites. You are a woman working in the minority in that. What's your experience like? 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Interestingly, the number of women moving into male-dominated jobs, while it's increased dramatically, the number of men going into female-dominant careers has not increased anywhere near that amount. That's probably for a future segment on Air Talk. Joining us is Sarah Cheney, economy reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who wrote the piece, Women Wanted, Blue-Collar Fields, Find New Workforce. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Larry.
So what appears to be the economic driver for more women entering these jobs?
Right. It seems that there are really a number of factors driving the trend in women increasingly taking blue-collar roles. For one, you have companies broadening recruiting efforts in a tight labor market. So companies are looking for workers to fill roles in plumbing and manufacturing and truck driving, and they have traditionally looked to men. But given that they're facing kind of a lack of workers, lack of available workers, they're now turning more to women. There's also the draw of pay for women. So a construction job, for instance, pays on average much more than a personal aid role. And so women are increasingly drawn to these jobs because they realize, hey, I can make more money. And then you also have the fact that women are realizing that they won't be alone.
Well, so the question would be then, as women enter these jobs that are more male-dominated, are they finding satisfaction in the compensation that leads them to want to stay? Is that potentially attracting other women? Again, I'd love to hear from you. If you're an AirTalk listener, you work in a traditionally male field, particularly a blue-collar kind of job, what we've traditionally called that, where it's physical work, or you're driving, you're working in a warehouse, you're out at a construction site, jobs that have typically been very male dominant. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us is Gad Levinon, who's chief economist at the Conference Board, a nonprofit research firm. They've contributed data to the Wall Street Journal piece that Sarah reported. Gad, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So what do you see as the effect of more women going into these jobs? Has it affected compensation at all, affected these industries at all?
I think it's hard to tell yet, but I think the fact that women now are more of an option as recruits, I think it increases the supply of workers, and that helps keep wage growth down a little. Wage growth in transportation has been growing extremely fast, and having more candidates helps a little in that.
I'd say just in my small sample size, I had a couple of long drives. I went to Phoenix back in March. I was just up the weekend before last, went up Sacramento on Interstate 5. And the number of women I see driving trucks now, driving rigs, is so much higher than I used to see. Again, I'd love to hear from you. If you drive a truck, if you do deliveries, you work in a warehouse, in construction, in traditional male fields, I'd like to hear about what led you to make that switch and what the work environment is like for you. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. We'll be back with more on Air Talk right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Our focus is on women working in what have been male-dominant careers in what's typically called the blue-collar sector. And this is working in logistics, drivers, working in factories, on construction sites. If you're a woman who's working in that field, I'd love to hear from you what attracted you to it, what you see as the payoffs that you're getting, you know, compensation or otherwise, and the challenges in moving into these kinds of jobs. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Maria, in downtown Los Angeles, understand you're a carpenter.
Yes.
How long have you been working in that profession?
I've been a carpenter for 29 years.
Oh, wow. So you, when you started work, were you one of the few women doing that?
Yes. Most times I was the only woman on the job site.
Wow. And so what, you know, going back three decades, how welcome were you, or how many obstacles were there?
There were many obstacles. A lot of people didn't believe that a woman could do it. And I spent my career showing them that a woman could.
Wow, that's great. So today, especially now that you've established yourself personally, how different is it? And do you think it's significantly different for young women going into the field who are new at it?
Well, I think nowadays it's more accepted that women move into a non-traditional role, whereas, you know, when I first began, it was frowned upon. People said, hey, why are you doing that? It seemed like you were a little crazy if you wanted to do something like that. But, you know, it's not crazy to make the same wage as the man standing next to you.
And was that one of the things that was appealing for you right off, is that working as a carpenter, the compensation would be higher than for a traditionally women's field job?
Well, I was drawn to it because of the work, and the equal pay was just a bonus.
All right. So you're still doing the work as a carpenter?
Yes. I still work as a carpenter downtown L.A. The important thing is the pension and the health care and the state-of-the-art training. And what we enjoy is that you earn while you learn and that there's no giant student loan at the end. The schooling is paid for through the union.
That's nice. And so is this a combination of formal education and apprenticeship, or how did you learn the craft?
Well, through apprenticeship and on-the-job training. So
okay.
You go out as a first-level apprentice. Some people don't even know how to measure or cut or do anything. The guys on the job or the journeyman that you're assigned to kind of helps you along, makes sure that you stay safe and so on and guides you. And then also you learn bookwork and hands-on projects while you're in the apprenticeship school. So there are two ways that you can learn. And, we cover 87 different jurisdictions as a carpenter. So there are so many different things to know.
That's great.
You spend your career learning everything.
Maria, wonderful story. Thank you so much. Carpenter for nearly three decades in downtown L.A., 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. James writes on the page, there's a Costco where the entire tire center is female, or at least it was on the day that I visited, 866-893-KPECC. Sarah Cheney of the Wall Street Journal, you were writing that when it comes to auto mechanics, more and more women are going into that well-compensated field.
Yes, yeah, correct. We saw that occur with auto mechanics, also the share of delivery drivers, electricians, and plumbers who are women recently touched the highest level in 25 years on records. What we found was that the trend in the number of women increasingly taking blue-collar roles has been especially prominent in transportation and material moving, which includes truck drivers. And we spoke to a number of truck drivers who were drawn to the profession for various reasons. One woman in particular was at a family reunion, and she heard from a truck driver there that he saw many women on the road, and that kind of encouraged her to enter the field.
Yeah, as I said, again, small sample size, but I noticed a distinct difference. 866-893-KPCC. Cindy in Granada Hills says, I'm a truck driver for the movie industry. People are really accepting women in non-traditional roles these days. I feel like there's a lot of opportunity in these jobs. As a trucker, we make a lot of money. We get a lot of overtime. It's a great job for single moms who need money. That's Cindy in Granada Hills. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. EGW writes on the page, Demo Diva, a woman-owned demolition company, uses pink excavators, pink loaders, pink dump trucks, etc. as their brand. The owner's built a multimillion-dollar business. She credits the female-owned branding as her secret weapon. 866-893-KPECC. Let's talk with Lisa in Glendale. Lisa, what field do you work in?
I work in the film industry, and I'm a technician, and I've been doing it about 30 years.
All right.
And it was basically, for a long time, I was the only one of maybe two or three female technicians in what I do in sound mixing. And now we've got so many more coming into the field. And, I did it because my parents, always kind of let us do what we wanted to do and didn't restrict us. But I think there was a lot of pushback, certainly for me, for a woman in a technical field.
Well, and how long did you find, when you started, how long did it take for you to show you had the same passion for this, skills, and sort of convince your peers that that you were serious about this and you entered it for the same reasons they did?
It took a while. I was lucky to start in documentaries where it was a much more openness to women mm-hmm. working. And the motion picture business, and television, it took a lot longer, just because the producers weren't used to it. And I, believe it or not, still to this day, get surprised that, you know, that, oh, you're this, you do this, you know, I didn't know women did this.
Wow.
So there's quite a few more of us these days, and we're all in the union, you know, it's all a union job. But it took a long time.
So Lisa, it's got to be exciting for you to see young women coming into the field where you've been working so long.
Absolutely. All of us that have been doing this for a while are very supportive, and we're, you know, we definitely love, you know, as we love all our colleagues.
Yeah, but to see the next generation coming up, that's great. Lisa, thank you so much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Connie in Culver City, I understand you're a plumber?
I am a plumber.
How long have you been doing that?
I have been in the industry for 15 years. I started out in the office and I moved into the field about 7 years ago.
That's great. And you have your own company, I understand?
Yes, I have my own company.
That's great. And so is it, do you think it is an advantage or a disadvantage being a woman working in a field where it's not typical to have a woman show up to deal with your plumbing problem?
Well, at first in the industry, when I first stepped into the field, I got a lot of surprised looks from both the other people in the trade, the men in the trade that I met mostly, and then I've met two other women plumbers since then. And everybody seems to know who the women plumbers are, all the men. And at first, they were a little hesitant, but when they saw how passionate I was about what I do in the field, they just came on board with it. But what I found in the trades is that there's been more women coming into the trades, mostly wives and daughters. And in the plumbing field, it's mostly because the people in the field are aging out, and we need new people to start coming into the field. And that's how I actually started getting into the field, was because we couldn't find people to do the work that we did.
And you're the wife of a plumber, I understand?
I am. We are no longer together.
Okay.
It started out as I was the wife of a plumber, and then we split up. He started another company. I kept our company, and it's flourished. The most surprising thing that I found in the field was that customers, when I go to the door on a service call, and women answer the door, they're so relieved to see a woman there. And they're like, they had no idea that I would actually be the person showing up to the service call.
Well, and do you have people that assume you must be good? A woman working as a plumber, you've got to know your stuff. Do you feel like that you sort of get extra credit for that?
Well, what happens is I have to be five times better than someone else coming in. Because as a woman, I'm judged more harshly on the work I do. I find that with inspectors, oftentimes with inspectors, I get judged a lot harsher than, let's say, my coworkers or my. I have a team of crew that I work with, and we both may be sitting for an inspection, the exact same job,
yeah,
different locations. And we'll have the same inspector. They'll come to my job, and then they'll go to the other job, and I get judged more harshly than the other person.
Well, I'd assume you are five times better. Connie, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it. Connie in Culver City with her own plumbing company will take more calls, talking about women who've entered what are traditionally male-dominant blue-collar field. 866-893-KPECC. We'll talk with Pat, who for years was a general maintenance engineer working on high-rises. If you're someone who drives a truck, works in a warehouse, has worked on construction sites, a woman who's worked in what are non-traditional fields for women, I'd like to hear your experience. 866-893-KPCC. Back in a minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about women working in what have traditionally been considered men's jobs, male-dominated blue-collar jobs. and so many more women going into those careers, whether it's driving trucks, doing deliveries, working in warehouses, in construction, working mechanics positions. 866-893-KPECC. Hetty Lynn Hurdy said, I was among the first female in technicians. Let me just find Hetty's. I was among the first female videotape engineers at NBC at 30 Rock in New York. The men were not happy. Hetty, thank you for sharing that. 866-893-KPCC. Jennifer just tweeted at AirTalk regarding women in blue-collar jobs. Leuna and the city of Phoenix have an apprenticeship class for sanitation drivers. Our newest class, while small, is 50% women. It's also the only apprenticeship program like it in the nation. Jennifer, thank you for sharing that. And those, of course, are very well-compensated jobs with good public employment. Employee benefits, driving sanitation trucks, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Yvonne and Tustin said, your caller just hit on a main struggle. Women in traditionally men's roles have to prove self twice as hard as a man. Men act surprised when a woman knows as much, if not more, than they do for the same job. That has to change. Norma in Lakewood says there are a lot of women forklift drivers at USPS, the post office. Yeah, you absolutely see that. Let's talk with Pat, who's in Mount Washington in L.A. Pat, I understand you were a general maintenance engineer on high-rises for years.
Yes, I'm technically called a stationary operating engineer. I began in 1979, one of the first women in my union, and I retired in 2011.
All right. And so what was it like for you being one of the few or perhaps only women working in a job like this?
Sometimes it's difficult because the men weren't used to seeing somebody like, you know, women. And me being under 5 feet tall, that added a little bit more of a challenge. But I just worked very hard to prove myself and prove to them that I wanted to be there, and that while I couldn't do the same things that a 6 foot person could do, there were a lot of things I could do that they couldn't do.
Yeah.
So it became a trade-off in helping each other.
Do you know if in the specific kind of work you did, there are more women entering that field?
There are some. We're not as populous as far as women as the carpenters and the electricians and a couple other trades. And it's unfortunate because we have steady jobs where they work and then they get laid off. But in the 32 years that I worked, I only worked in three different buildings. And for the entire 32 years of carrying the tools, I was only out of work for about 3 months.
Wow. I mean, and these are what, upper middle class jobs we're talking about in terms of compensation?
We make a good salary. There's no doubt about that.
Pat,
I went to college first, and I didn't make anywhere near the kind of money with my college degree as I did as an operating engineer.
Pat, appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your experience, and congratulations on your more than three decades in that field. Yvonne in La Crescenta says, I'm 61. When I got to junior high, I tried to take shop, was told I could not because I was a girl. I'm so happy to hear all these women who've succeeded in this route. That's Yvonne in La Crescenta. Erin in Glacelle Park says, I'm a carpenter and framer. I work with frame artists, so I build frames for their artwork. I've been doing this professionally for the past couple of years. I'd say most of my clients are women. That's been great for business. I've been framing on the side for extra income. That's Erin in Glacelle Park. Annie in Santa Monica, good to have you with us. I understand you're a baseball umpire.
Yes.
So what league do you work in?
I work in the LA unit and the South Bay unit for high school baseball. And I also do lower division.
Yeah, that's great. And are there very many other women who are working as baseball umpires locally?
Not that I know of. I've met a few at the Major League Training Center, but that's pretty much it. There's just a handful.
All right. First of all, what are some of the challenges? Do you feel that you are treated differently being a woman in this position of authority?
I think I'm tested a little bit, maybe more extremely, but I'm also encouraged more generously by everyone because they're the other fellow umpires and
coaches, et cetera, for the most part, are willing to support you and see what you can do and encourage you to move up the ladder.
So does that feel good to have them sort of go out of their way to be welcoming, or does that the other side of that, you don't like being treated differently?
No, it's a boost. It's basically a boost because it's generally a bit of an intimidating field. And so you feel like if you have that support and you're not at all feeling like they don't want you there. So that little extra boost can just help you. It's not, you're never feeling discriminated negatively, but the boost doesn't seem patronizing either. It seems just honest.
Authentic, yeah. Annie, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Annie in Santa Monica, who is baseball umpire. Perry in West Hill says, I sell solar panels and roofing. I'm the only woman on my team. For me, it's a big help. The people are so impressed when I go through the front door because I'm a woman. I've been in this field for about 6 years. The only person who wouldn't talk to me was a woman. That's Barry in West Hills sharing her experience. Thank you for these wonderful stories. I appreciate it so much. It's just great to hear women working in what have traditionally been male-dominated blue-collar fields, moving there because of either the compensation or just tremendous interest that's driven them into that field. My thanks to Wall Street Journal economy reporter Sarah Cheney, who wrote on this in Women Wanted, Blue-Collar Fields Find New Workforce, and chief economist for the Conference Board, Gad Lebanon. We have much more to come in the second hour of Air Talk right here on 89.3. Hit song for Janet Jackson from the John Singleton film, Poetic Justice. Singleton suffered a massive stroke just about 2 weeks ago, went into a coma, and yesterday passed away at the age of 51. Singleton, with a huge impact with his films set here in Los Angeles, exploring issues of the black community in L.A. for those of us that grew up here, a real sense of place, a real sense of complex human beings, in particular time in Los Angeles. Singleton nailed that beautifully with his characters, his screenplays, and his direction. Boys in the Hood, of course, what brought him to prominence, his very first feature film. And this powerful scene with Lawrence Fishburne and Cuba Gooding Jr. as Fishburne's son.
Trey? Trey, what are you doing? Huh? Oh, you bad now, huh? You bad. You gotta shoot somebody now, huh? Well, here I am. Come on, shoot me. You bad, right? Look, I'm sorry about your friend. My heart goes out to his mother and his family, but that's their problem, Trey. You my son, you my problem. I want you to give me the gun. Oh, I see. You want to end up like little Chris in a wheelchair, huh? Right? No, you want to end up like Doughboy, huh? No? Give me the motherfucking gun, Trey!
Lawrence Fishburne, Cuba Gooding Jr. in a classic scene from Boys in the Hood, nominated for Best Director for that film. John Singleton, I think the youngest to have that honor. KPCC film critic Tim Cockshill joining us to remember the wonderful work that was done by Singleton, who again passed away yesterday at the age of 51. Tim, just your thoughts about his passing, because you saw the career over its full arc.
Yeah. I wasn't born here, Larry, but I arrived in 1989, before there was a John Singleton, and I watched the entire arc of that, of his career as it happened. Boys in the Hood, I did the junket for that. I worked the red carpet for that. I interviewed him for that movie and every other subsequent movie for the next, almost 30 years. My heart goes out to his mother, with whom I'm acquainted. And you know, I would see John occasionally just in Hollywood, in informal sort of subjects, and we would just chit-chat about movies. John loved movies. The reason why that scene is so good, people forget sometimes because he made his bones as a director. John went to USC as a writing student. He got his degree as a writer. He was a wonderful writer. And that scene is beautiful because it's beautifully written. He loved John Ford films. That had a very sort of Gary Cooper quality.
I was
going to
say, that's not a gangster film scene. That's a Western scene.
Yeah, yeah. He was well-educated in cinema and knew a whole lot about movies. Those first few films, John wanted to talk about his community. Boys in the Hood was a film about South Central Los Angeles. So John was doing there what Spike had done for East Coast filmmakers a few years earlier. He made a film about his community, the people in his community, people like him. There's so much truth in Boys in the Hood. It's why it resonates to this very day. The same thing with the next few films, Poetic Justice, the film that gave us Tupac Shakur as an actor and Janet Jackson as a significant actress. A beautiful scene in that film with Maya Angelou where they visit a picnic. They sort of crash this family picnic, and they're accepted right into the group of the family because, you know, black folks look at each other and say, okay, come on in and have some food. And Uncle Joey, a beautiful, beautiful scene, again, full of truth and verisimilitude, and that's one of the things that John was so, so good at.
Came out of Blair High School in Pasadena City College, as you just said, Tim, accepted into the very prestigious writers program. This was a young man that people seemed to know he was going places. When you hear people talk about him as a young man, he was out hustling, working as a PA on different projects. He worked on Arsenio Hall's talk show where he met a lot of people. I mean, he really had a sense of where he wanted to go.
Yeah, interesting. He pointed himself at filmmaking second. Wanted to study to be a computer technologist first. It was a big thing in the early 90s. Everybody was doing it. But it didn't take him very long to realize that he had a knack for storytelling. And he pointed himself at that, and he never took his foot off the gas. Recently, John has been just shepherding all kinds of talent, young talent. He has a series on called Snowfall about the arrival of cocaine in South, what we used to call South Central Los Angeles. A beautiful, beautiful television series. If you look at the names of the directors and the producers in that series, you're going to see a whole lot of names of young black men and women that John said, you can do it. And he gave them a shot. He let them jump. So that's what he's been doing lately, and it's just so, so wonderful.
51 years of age, such a young man to lose John Singleton. Another film that I really loved, and it just seemed like it came and went, didn't get a lot of attention, was Baby Boy, again, set in South Los Angeles. Just to me, again, so captured the characters, the sense of place.
Yeah. Another film where John was writing about his community, full of characters that reflected the folks that he knew, his cousins, his friends. And I got to tell you, as an African-American, I saw all of my cousins and uncles in that movie, too. And I know that you, Larry, from Inglewood, were familiar with that. So John wasn't afraid to do that.
These were people I knew, too. I just felt like these... And it's so rare to see people like that in a movie. Like, yeah, I know these folks.
Yeah. John wasn't afraid to do that. Some black filmmakers over the years have shied away from the notion of enfranchising what might have been thought to be stereotypes about black folks in the community. But John was able to capture these people with a truth and in a reality that didn't represent any sort of a stereotype, but just a reality of what was in the neighborhood. But he also captured the family and the heart and the dignity of the community as well.
And the challenges that the family faced. And what I love about that film, Baby Boy, is he puts you right in there with the family where you're trying to figure, how would I deal with this? If I was his mother, if I was, you know, if I was a sibling, how would I deal with the character and the challenges that he has in that film? And that's the art of it.
Yeah. And people forget Boys in the Hood was a studio film. Columbia's 5 years later, she's got to have that was an independent film. That film probably never played more than 500 theaters at any one given time over its entire run. But Baby Boy was the film that played in 3,000, Boys in the Hood was the film that played in 3,000 theaters. The whole nation got to see for the first time, this is what it's like to live in an inner city urban community. The things that we think about it are true, but it is deeper and more and full of more humanity than had been represented before and probably has been since.
Tim Cogshell, KPCC Film Week critic, joining us as we talk about the death of John Singleton at the age of 51, first African-American director nominated for an Oscar, that for Boys in the Hood. What an extraordinary at age 24.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary.
Particularly since, again, he did not come out of the directing program at that school. John taught himself to direct by watching movies. John taught himself to direct by paying attention on movie sets and on TV shoots. And I just think that that was extraordinary. He learned the craft of writing in that program. He certainly did. But how to direct, he learned on the job, and he won an Oscar. They got that Oscar nomination the very first time out.
Does he have, to your knowledge, any protégés, people that sort of learned under him, and you think that he influenced with their films?
Well, I will say this. Beginning in 1991 with Boys in the Hood, John put a whole bunch, Kevin Sullivan, a whole bunch of folks on the path. Perhaps not names that we would know, but this is what's wonderful about it. They are the rank-and-file directors and producers working on the television programs, the sitcoms that you watch every day. And those names go by, and they say directed by, and they're not famous. But you know what? They're working because John Singleton gave them their shot and gave them their career. And that's the kind of person that I think really, really owes John Singleton a debt of gratitude.
Finally, Tim, he wasn't shy about criticizing the film industry for how Black people's stories are told. You know, he was very critical and felt that there'd been neglect in that area. You've also been, you know, very, very clear about your critique of how Hollywood, you think, has neglected those stories. Do you see any change on that front?
I do. A significant change, too. Not only when it comes to African Americans, but when it comes to women. The problem now doesn't happen to be with Black folks. It happens to be with women and other people of color. But for African-Americans, there has been opportunity that led us up to Barry Jenkins, that led us up to Black Panther, that led us through Beale Street. Beautiful, beautiful movies that are being recognized now, not just by Black folks, but by brown folks, too. So, yeah, John is definitely part of that path that has brought us to where we are now in Hollywood. And for people of color in Hollywood, it is much better than it was in 1991, when John made that first movie.
Well, and sadly, there's just so much more great work that he would have done had we had him longer.
I can only tell you that if you look at John Singleton's IMDb, you will be deeply impressed. Don't just look at the director's credit. Look at the producer's credit.
A lot of stuff.
Hustle and Flow, Black Snake, Moan, Woo, so many television shows. John Singleton, executive producer, producer. Giving his credibility, his name to those projects made those projects happen.
Tim, thanks so much. Appreciate your coming and talking with us about the legacy of John Singleton, who's left us all too young at 51.
Indeed.
Tim Cogshell, KPCC Film Week critic, speaking with me earlier today. Also joining us, the director of the aforementioned Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan, two films produced by John Singleton, the director of those two films, Craig Brewer. Thank you so much for being with us. Your thoughts on what John Singleton has left us in film.
Well, I mean, he's left a tremendous legacy. I was just thinking about that today. You know, there's a lot of us that are, you know, it always takes a death to realize just how much a person has meant to you, not just in your life, but just in the work that they leave behind. And I'm one of those guys that I owe my career to John Singleton. There's a lot of people that owe their careers to John Singleton. I work with Taraji P. Henson, Terrence Howard. I work with 3-6 Mafia, and all. I mean, there's so many other actors and artists that some of the greatest moments of their life in their career would not have happened if John hadn't given us an opportunity. So there's so much to say about him, but I think the greatest part of his legacy is how much he helped others create their own legacy. And in Hollywood, that doesn't happen much. It really doesn't. There are some vanity projects, I think, where people go like, oh, I'm going to have a big label, I'm going to have a big studio. But like, they're not really getting completely invested in the artists themselves. And John was very much a person that had to connect with you on a what he would call a soulful level. You know, I think that that's something that when John read Hustle and Flow and saw my first movie that I had made on a pawn shop bought camera, he was like, you know, this isn't like a black film. This isn't a white film. You're from Memphis, Tennessee. You're from like the South, and you're not, your stories aren't really being represented. And that's why he got behind me. You know, I think that he felt that there was a urgency of storytelling that I really wanted to come from a place in the country that he got.
Yeah.
And he knew Hollywood wasn't really paying attention to that part of the country at the time. I mean, it's now in fashion. It's now in vogue, you know, both in the rap community and in movies to explore not only Southern stories, but African-American Southern stories. John was, you know, when everybody else was saying, can you move it to Los Angeles? You know, can you change it? John was the one that said, no, this is what's going to make it unique, make Hustle and Flow unique and special. So much to the fact that a lot of people don't know this, but, you know, every studio closed their doors to Stephanie Elaine, the producer, and John and myself. And it was John who put his house up for Collateral.
Wow.
And financed Hustle and Flow on his own. That's the biggest mistake that people say you can make in the business, is you never put your own money in anything.
Yeah, and he did.
He,
you know, with Black Snake Moan, you had a film that there's some controversy about the themes that are there. It definitely has an edge. It's extremely unconventional, the film. And how did John, in his conversations with you, Craig, sort of frame how you were going to respond to that?
It's interesting you bring that up, because I remember, I'm going to have to go back one film to answer that. I was very new to Hollywood with Hustle and Flow, and John knew that. He was not only a mentor to me on the set, but he was a mentor to me in how to respond and feel when people respond and criticize and voice their opinions about your film. And no one gives, there's not a class for that. There's not really, not many people put a chapter in their filmmaking books about that part of it, because so much of what you're dealing with is the effort itself, the product itself. No one really tells you how to deal with response, because it is something that, you know, you can be a confident artist or director, but you still feel it. You still feel that kind of anxiety. And so when Hustle started coming out, you know, we had the same kind of controversies. It was like, here's this pimp, and are we really going to see this kind of representation again? And, you know, John was, he was the one that really prepped me for that and said, as long as we tell the truth, then we're, you know, that there's nothing really anybody can say about that. There was a part of John too, as much as he was an advocate for, you know, advancing the conversation about race, there was also a big part of him that was also like against, kind of like a you know, one could say like a political correct environment where you couldn't do or say things that he felt were real. And so, you know, you look at Boys in the Hood, and it's kind of like, or especially Baby Boy.
Yeah, Baby Boy is one we were just talking about.
I mean, Baby Boy I understand, I was there for that cultural moment of Boys in the Hood, but Baby Boy is so real, it's uncomfortable for people, I think, sometimes, yeah, to deal with. Baby Boy begins with a scene where a man's taking his girlfriend to get an abortion. Can you imagine a studio film nowadays where like that script shows up? I mean, what do you think their first note's going to be? But John was like, no, this is real. This is what's happening. So when Black Snake Moan came about and he read it, he immediately wanted to do it. He was like, oh, we're doing this, because he understood that my passion for these kinds of stories and characters is that I still believe that, you know, people on the margins, people who don't have much, people who normally would cross the side, you know, to the other side of the street to get away from, that they have the capacity of love. They have capacity to bond to each other. And he saw that in the movie. And he's like, I know everybody's going to be seeing this black man chaining a white woman to a radiator, and they're going to get all mad at you and everything like that. But you have to hold, not only in making the movie, but in representing the movie afterwards, to what we believe in, which is that, you know, people that are very different can still connect, love, and get through life together. And that was a very John Singleton, that was on brand for John. That's who he wanted to represent, and the kind of art that he wanted to champion.
We're talking with director Craig Brewer. He directed the feature films Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan, films that were produced by the late John Singleton, who died yesterday at the age of 51. Singleton, known, of course, as the tremendous young director, 24, of Boys in the Hood, and followed up with Poetic Justice and Baby Boy, did Too Fast, Too Furious, the second installment in that series. But we're talking also about the ways in which he supported other filmmakers in their work. Craig, if you could, don't mind hanging on, we're going to take a break and come back, continue our conversation, and longtime friend of John Singleton, film producer Steve Nicolaitis, is going to join us as well. He produced Boys in the Hood. We're going to go back and talk about his memories of his friend and his colleague. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Back in just a minute.
One in a million, vote for your baby. One in a million, listen, it drives you wild. One in a million, vote for your baby. One in a million, listen, it drives you wild.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. As we remember filmmaker John Singleton, who died yesterday at the age of 51, almost 2 weeks after he suffered a stroke and was hospitalized at Cedars in intensive care, and then yesterday life support was removed. His legacy, an extraordinary one, both as director and as producer, of course, writer as well. We heard a wonderful example earlier of just an iconic scene from Boys in the Hood. I'm so glad, though, to hear director Craig Brewer of Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan talk about other films that were done by John Singleton as well, because just, you know, such a huge talent, and his impact on other filmmakers so big too. In addition to Craig Brewer, we're joined by Steve Nicolaitis, who is film producer, longtime friend of John Singleton, produced a number of his films, including Boys in the Hood. Steve, first of all, our condolences on the passing of your friend. First of all, your feelings about his death yesterday.
Well, thank you, Larry, for including me. I met John. I had just finished working on the movie Misery, and I didn't want to work for a long time. It was the summertime, and my family went to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to take my son to the Basketball Hall of Fame, and Stephanie Lane called me up and said, I just read the greatest script that I've ever read, and you've got to produce this. And I said, just to shut her up, I said, okay, send it to me. And I read it, and I love Westerns. I love morality. I love heroes. And when I read Boys in the Hood, this was a Western. This was morality. This was the character Trey, which should have been played by James Stewart. And the character of Doughboy should have been played by Lee Marvin or somebody like that. You know, and I said, okay, done. I'm there. And then I went to John's mom's house in Pasadena, where I lived. I lived on Hill Avenue for many, many years, just up the street from KPBC. Sheila served us lemonade from her tree, and I said to John, why me? And John said, because you worked on my favorite movie of all time, which was Stand By Me. And, you know, after the shoot of Boys in the Hood and after the celebrity of Boys in the Hood, I was in a van with Rob Reiner on a survey a few men. He said, why did Doughboy fade out like we did with Chris and Stand By Me? And I said, don't you get it, man? This movie was an homage to Stand By Me. The fat kid with the striped shirt and the kids looking for a dead body. And so, anyway.
Yeah. And you, did you have a sense? I mean, here he is in his early 20s. Obviously, you know, the intelligence comes through and the commitment. But did you have any trepidation at all about him helming this project?
Absolutely. His office was next to mine in a little teeny office building in Leimert Park. And I would hear him watching Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark or stuff like that. And I would go in there and say, you know, maybe you should look at American Graffiti and Sugarland Express, because we're not doing Star Wars here. You know, we don't have
no special effects in Boys in the Hood.
Yeah, no, none of that kind of stuff. And but the thing about John is that he listened to you. He took what advice you offered to him. He was never furious about challenging him. He was just a sweetheart, you know. Basically, I mean, all of us who know him, all of us who were especially there at the beginning, know that he was the sweetest knucklehead we ever met in our lives, and that's the truth. He was just a really good person that everybody rallied around and everybody supported, including, you know, your two guests. Although the first guest, who I think his name is Tim.
Tim Cockshell, yeah.
Yeah, he said Boys in the Hood was in 3,000 theaters. No, it wasn't. It opened at 811 theaters and it never got wider.
Really? Even with the extraordinary word of mouth for the film?
Even with the extraordinary word of mouth. It was back in the day when DVDs and VHSs were, you know, the cash cow for studios. And so they never expanded the release, but they, I remember hearing once that the initial sales of DVD and VHS was like $75 million, which is, and they ever pronounced box office for Boys in the Hood.
Wow. We're talking with Steve Nikolaitis, a film producer, longtime friend of John Singleton. He produced several of Singleton's films, including Boys in the Hood, Poetic Justice, and the rebooted Chaff with Samuel L. Jackson. We're also talking with Craig Brewer, the director of Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan. Craig, I wanted to ask you about hey, Craig, what about, I mean, you talked about the influence that he had on your career and how important he was, but are there a lot of other people like yourself that you'd say that John Singleton was really key to their careers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, here's what's kind of interesting. Like, I was in the writer's room on Empire. That I was working on, and the writer's room assistant, this guy Rob Smith, I was talking about something, and I brought up John Singleton. He's like, "Oh yeah, man, that's my guy." You know, John Singleton would call me up every once in a while, and just give me advice on movies. You know, and I was like, "Man, you don't know how many times someone has told me that." Where John will just call it, like, we'll find out someone's got an interest, and suddenly they got a new big brother. John was that way. And so it's so funny that you're talking about hearing him playing Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark, because I got John at a time when John had a big leather satchel that was filled with DVDs and Blu-rays, and he took them everywhere. And you'd be really surprised to see what you would see in there. You would see Superfly and Penitentiary. But you would also see like 400 Blows by Truffaut and, you know, La Dolce Vita by Fellini. You know, he was all over the map with his love for cinema. And so, like, when we were preparing for Hustle and Flow, he said, hey, man, what three movies do you want to study? And I was like, okay, let's watch Midnight Cowboy. Let's watch Taxi Driver and Saturday Night Fever. And so John still had those offices over in Leimert Park, and he had projectors, like 35 millimeter projectors. And he would hire projectionists to come in, and he'd call the studio, get a print.
Wow.
So there we are in this like makeshift, like, I mean, I'm sitting on like old couches and stuff, and he's, you know, blaring the volume, and we were watching, you know, not on DVD or Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I'm talking about like just watching movies, and Stephanie Elaine would be on like my left and John Singleton would be on my right. And John would just, if you watch the movie with John, it's truly an emotional experience. Because he does not hide his feeling. He shouts at the screen. He laughs. He punches you in the arm when he likes something. Look at that. Look at that. Look at that shot. Look at that. And it's so interesting you bring up Westerns, because if you look at John's work, he's old school filmmaker. He's mm-hmm. not one of these guys that's like, oh, let's just get a bunch of coverage and then we'll cut it together and figure it out in post. He's trying to do like really like spare masters where people are moving within the frame. And that's like he'll reference John Ford. He'll reference Kubrick and Wells.
Well, and as Steve was saying earlier, Boyd in the Hood, the Western elements are just unmistakable. Gentlemen, we're too quickly out of time. Thank you for sharing your personal memories, your reflections on John Singleton, who died yesterday. That's Craig Brewer, the director of Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan and many episodes of Empire. Steve Nicolaitis, who produced a number of Singleton's films, including Boys in the Hood, Poetic Justice, and Shaft. It's Air Talk on 89.3. Time for an update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us as Jared Diamond returns to the program. A brand new book for the UCLA professor of geography. That title, of course, doesn't do him justice. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner for his book Guns, Germs, and Steel. His book Collapse continued with the themes of what environmental challenges have been faced by different civilizations around the world. And his latest book is Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. Instead of looking only at the issue of the environment, however, what factors into the long-term health of civilizations. He looks here at traumatic experiences of different nations and how they have dealt with that, what has enabled them to revive after a period of tremendous loss or setback. Jared, great to have you with us again on Air Talk.
It's nice to be back with you, Larry, as always.
I appreciate it. So here you look at seven different historic examples of nations that have undergone crisis. And you use sort of the human experience of trauma as a way of looking at how nations have done that. What gave you sort of the template for this book?
The template came from two things. One is that, as I reflect, Larry, on the countries where I've lived, all of them have either been undergoing or undergone or about to undergo crises. Not that I caused them, it just happens that way. And the other is that my wife, as a clinical psychologist, was doing a specialty training in crisis therapy. That's to say, people undergoing personal crises such as breakup of a relationship, death, health setback. And as Marie talked to me about the outcome predictors that helped her and her fellow therapists understand whether a person was succeeding in dealing with a crisis by changing and responding, it dawned on me similar predictors apply to also the outcomes of national crises, such as whether you acknowledge that you're in a crisis, whether you accept responsibility, you can do something about it, whether you get help or don't get help, whether you look for models.
And all of these can be tremendous challenges for countries. First of all, being willing to admit the crisis, because people that are in positions of power We'll do that insofar as they can sort of leverage more power, that they're the answer to that, not necessarily to honestly confront that. And then secondly, taking responsibility. That's very difficult for countries to say, yes, we've brought this upon ourselves.
It's as painful for countries to admit that we contributed to this mess. But if you don't admit that we contributed to this mess, you can't change your behavior and get out of the mess. That's true for people. It's routinely true with a breakup of a marriage to admit that you did something to produce this. But it's also true for countries. For example, nowadays, the United States is wrestling with major problems. And there's a temptation to say, that's the fault of China, Canada, and Mexico. Poor us, we're victims, rather than recognizing there's something that we Americans are doing that produced this effect. What can we do to change it?
You explicitly avoid here U.S. Difficulties in dealing with our politics right now. You avoid Brexit, you know, which is the ongoing crisis in the U.K. and the European Union. And one is that just because it's too close. We're in the middle of it right now.
It's two reasons, Larry. One is, this is a book. This is not a magazine article. If it were a magazine article, I can say something that would be out of date next week. But this is a book, and my books stay in print for 30 years, and I don't want to say something which is going to be out of date next week. Therefore, in my book, the name Trump does not appear except in the prologue to say this is the last mention of Trump. And also Brexit does not appear because whatever I said would be out of date.
Because we don't know where that's going. Let's take the example of Japan, one of the seven sort of case examples that you give here. How did it go through its crisis period?
Japan went through a crisis in the past, and it went through one more recently and is going through one now. The past crisis was that Japan kept itself isolated from the outside world with admitting no visitors and not letting any Japanese go abroad until 1853, when an American fleet of modern warships sailed uninvited into Yokohama Harbor and demanded a treaty whereby Japan would look after shipwrecked American sailors. And the Japanese realized with these warships there's nothing they could do. They had to deal with the West. Otherwise, they might suffer the fate of China. That's to say, having wars and being defeated by the West. So the Japanese in 1853 to 1868 embarked on a crash program of change, changing some things but not other things, with the result that Japan adopted a Western constitution, Western education, Western gas lights, Western clothes, Western haircut, but they retained the Japanese language and writing system and the emperor. So a selective change, and out of it, Japan emerged strong, capable of resisting the West and, in fact, defeating Germany and Russia in two wars.
We're talking with Jared Diamond. His new book, Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. If you're a fan of Professor Diamond's work, either Guns, Germs, and Steel, Pulitzer Prize winner, or Collapse, a chance for you to join us to ask questions of him. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. And then, you know, in that particular crisis for Japan that you write about, of course, it wouldn't keep them from undergoing crisis in years to come. So this sort of you're writing about sort of how you deal with the in the moment problem in front of you.
That's right. Larry, you and I know, and every one of our listeners knows, that if you've overcome one crisis, you don't have smooth sailing for the rest of your life. You've overcome that until the next crisis. Japan dealt with the crisis of the arrival of the American fleet. Japan strengthened itself. And then came the crisis of World War II, the disastrous end of World War II. And now Japan faces new problems. They're not problems of atomic bombs, of the arrival of the American fleet. But Japan today is wrestling with the problems of a declining population, the role of women, an aging population, huge government debt, what to do about their relations with Korea and China. So Japan now is facing not a sudden explosive crisis, but a gently rolling crisis.
So let's move from the historic analysis into challenges today. One of the points you make is is the challenge in dealing with migration, because you've got people in places around the world who are suffering. They have unprecedented access to move to places that are going to give them a better life, and places that don't want to take or aren't able to take the full numbers of people who could benefit through relocation. How does the world generally deal with this issue that underlies Brexit, that is a fundamental issue involved with the Trump administration? So what do we learn from these past incidents to deal with this?
How does the world deal with the issue of migration? A short answer would be to say, without honest confrontation of the issue. The basic problem is that the 7.5 billion people in the world consist of less than 1 billion rich people, the United States, Western Europe, Australia, and Japan, and 6.5 billion people who are poorer, up to 30 times poorer. But the people in poor countries know that there are people in richer countries, and with globalization they can move, or they can vent their anger with terrorists. They can try to immigrate, as, for example, in Europe with 500 million rich Europeans. Near Europe are 1 billion Africans who are much poorer than Europe, and of course the Africans are trying to get to Europe. Europeans, as a result of World War II, have a guilty conscience and don't want to turn away refugees, but 1 billion refugees, there's no way that Europe can accommodate 1 billion refugees, except in the long run to do what they can to improve the economic situation of Africa. That's the only long-term solution to immigration.
And that's difficult because you're asking people to contribute significant amounts of their resources to a place where they're not going to see the result directly for that.
It sounds difficult, Larry, but the reality is that some of the biggest problems of poor countries are problems of public health. They're suffering from diseases like malaria and tuberculosis and AIDS and so on, and they don't have the funds to fix these diseases themselves. But the estimate is that it would cost $30 billion to solve the problems of the world's three biggest infectious diseases, namely malaria, AIDS, and TB. $30 billion, that sounds like a lot of money for you and me personally, but for various individuals like Bill Gates, from whose foundation I came yesterday, or for the American government, $30 billion is nothing. So it would be really cheap to help solve problems of poor countries, and thereby to help solve our own problems by investing in public health in poor countries.
Jared Diamond, UCLA professor of geography, joining us. His book, Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crises. He's written, I guess, what you'd call a trilogy now, with Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse. He's written many other books as well, including, I think, the first one when he joined us decades ago, The Third Chimpanzee. Jared Diamond is with us. We'll be back with more in 1 minute on Air Talk. I was looking at the daunting publicity tour that Jared Diamond is going to be taking. It seems like he's going to be everywhere, but here in Southern California, you have a chance to see him at the Aretani Theater, at the Japanese American Cultural and Community Center downtown L.A. coming up in just a couple of weeks. He'll be there 2 weeks from this Thursday for an evening event. We have the link on our AirTalk page, kpcc.org. He's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Guns, Germs, and Steel, MacArthur Grant recipient, and many, many more honors, National Academy of Sciences. He's a man who's has so many different interests and has in a sense sort of bifurcated his professional life, becoming an expert on different species around the world, living with different indigenous populations over a period of time, and then doing his research at UCLA for years as well. Jared Diamond's new book, Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crises. Let's do another historical look at Chile from Allende to Pinochet and how the country was traumatized.
Chile, Larry, when I've been trying out the material of my book on my UCLA undergraduates, because it's better to try out my book in front of friendly people before it's published than in front of unfriendly people after it's published. The case of Chile is the one that my students and I find most frightening, because what happened in Chile is that a country with a long history of democracy, the most democratic country in Latin America. I lived there in 1967 when my Chilean friends said, "We know how to govern ourselves. We're a democracy unlike those other Latin American countries." This was 5 years, 6 years before the coup d'etat under General Pinochet that smashed world records for sadism and torture, stayed in power for 17 years, and it was all because of the breakdown of democracy, a political polarization. But in the United States today, talk about political polarization. What happened in Chile, the risk is that democracy could end in the United States because of political polarization, not through a military coup, that won't happen here, but because of a increase in what's going on now, restrictions on voting, battles between legislatures and executives, interference of executives and legislatures in the judiciary. That's why the case of Chile is a frightening
case. So there's just no commonality that can be found. So how did Pinochet insert himself into that growing divide in Chile?
He inserted himself because a majority of Chileans themselves were frightened by what was happening under the democratically elected government of Chile under President Salvador Allende, who was a noble person and a leader in public health but had disastrous economic policies and foreign policies. So there became broad support in Chile for getting rid of Allende. There was also efforts on the part of our CIA to help those Chileans. What my Chilean friends didn't foresee is that the military government, instead of quickly getting replaced by another democratic government, would hang on, stay in power for 17 years, and indulge in such sadistic torture.
How then does Chile attempt to address what happened under the Pinochet dictatorship?
At the end of the Pinochet dictatorship, when Pinochet made the mistake of putting himself up for a plebiscite and the nation voted 55% to 45% not to elect him to another term as president, the socialists came back into power, but they recognized that 45% of the country had voted for Pinochet, even in a free election, so they could not take revenge on the torturers. Instead, the first president of Chile after Pinochet, in his inaugural address, said, "I want to build a Chile for all Chileans," which was a euphemism meaning a Chile where the torturers can live together with the tortured. It took enormous confidence in the unity of Chile to be willing to bring together the torturers and the tortured. But the result is that there has not been a massive seeking of revenge in Chile. Yes, there have been criminal trials, and a fair number of people have been put to jail, but Pinochet himself was never sent to jail.
You also used the case study of Germany as an example of a nation ultimately confronting its past and how essential that was for Germany moving forward.
I lived in Germany in 1961. I was there on the day that the wall was erected, at a time when Germany was still divided between East and West. Germans have been pitiless at acknowledging their responsibility for the Nazi atrocities of World War II. Many of my best friends are in Germany. German school children are sent to the remains of concentration camps. They're sent to Israel to understand what happened. So Germans have fully acknowledged responsibility for the bad things that they did. And that's made it possible for Germany to reestablish decent relationships with their worst victims, Poland, France, Russia. And it meant that when the opportunity arose for Germany to be reunited, Poland and France and Russia and Britain and the United States did not prevent German reunification.
Jared, great to have you with us again. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you, Larry,
being with us. Jared Diamond, Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. He'll be speaking about his book coming up a couple weeks from this Thursday at the Aretani Theater. the Japanese American Cultural and Community Center downtown Los Angeles. His book, looking at the challenges countries face at a time of crisis and the importance of treating countries in many ways as we treat trauma in humans. Have a great afternoon from all of us at AirTalk.